The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Safi Bacall. Safi is a second-generation physicist, the son of two astrophysicists, and a biotech entrepreneur. He got his BA summa cum laude in physics from Harvard and his PhD from Stanford. After working for 3 years as a consultant for McKinsey, he co-founded Cinta Pharmaceuticals, a biotechnology company developing new drugs for cancer, and served as CEO for 13 years. He served on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, working on the future of national research. He has a new book. It's called Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
I think maybe an interesting way to start this conversation is with the end of your book. In the afterword, you take issue with the term disruptive innovation. And you say, quote, "It's easy to point to technologies that disrupted a market in hindsight once the leaf has landed." Your book is about the conditions, the contexts, the systems, and the behaviors that need to be in place for any innovations to actually occur, which is different than this idea around disruptive innovation, right?
That's right. Yeah, I don't think anyone started in the back before, so that's kind of fun. I appreciate that.
Sure.
I have seen, and probably a lot of people have heard the words disruptive innovation get used to the point of almost the meaning is disappearing.
Right.
And the issue with that is that when someone comes and talks to you about, oh, this thing is going to disrupt the industry, it's usually a sign that they haven't worked very much on crazy new ideas, because people who have worked on crazy new ideas know, sort of like the analogy you were hinting at, that it's like a leaf in a tornado. It could end up anywhere. Mm-hmm. And for example, when people started working on the transistor in the 1940s, they had no idea where it would go. They thought it might be useful for building better telecommunication systems. It was being done inside Bell Labs. But when they built it, it turns out it wasn't reliable enough. They couldn't really use it. So they had no idea what to do with it for the first 5 years. Eventually, the first application was hearing aids. So you didn't have someone starting that project saying, let's go disrupt the hearing aid market. And that's the case with most crazy ideas. You try to challenge beliefs. You try to find things that go against the grain of accepted wisdom, because that's where the real breakthroughs lie. But you don't want to, it's a mistake to try to focus too much on what's the market potential. It's kind of a classic mistake to try to focus too much on the market potential. And that's kind of what I'm talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, in my years of being a theater producer at the Second City in Chicago, where we improvise productions towards a final script, one of the things, it took me actually a long time to learn that it is, you can't direct from at least a producer level for a show to go a certain way. You can't sort of say, well, I want you to end up having the most innovative show. What you need to do is hire amazing people. You have to give them the freedom to fail over and over again, which means you have to get out of their way, and then provide different kinds of support and sort of translation for their ideas to be accepted by the audience that's in front of them. But it's a process that happens over a long period of time, and it ebbs and flows. And there's a line in your book where you say structure may matter more than culture. And I think that's really true, because I think also the word culture, like disruptive innovation, has lost meaning.
Exactly. That's where I, by the way, I'm glad you brought up theater. Speaking of, one of my favorite examples, and I have a bunch of friends in the film industry, and so we used to talk for years about, we go to college, and obviously I was working in biotechnology and doing cancer drug development, and they were working on crazy film ideas, but it was just surprising to me how many similarities we had.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, in the film industry, there's the big majors, the Columbia, Universal, Paramount, and then the hundreds of small production shops working on crazy new film projects. The majors work on, you know, the next Avengers and the franchise projects. And in the biotech or drug discovery science world, it's similar. You have the Merck, Pfizer, Novartis working on the big franchise projects. And then you have the hundreds of small biotechs like mine working on crazy new ideas. And so one of the examples I like using that I learned about, it was so funny when I read about it, was from the film industry, was when Ian Fleming was trying to sell in the 1960s the rights to James Bond. He'd written these Bond movies, and the books were doing, you know, they had some pretty good success, but film studios in the U.S. weren't buying it. They said, you know, a British spy, you know, there's no market for that. Americans don't want to see that. And the first time when he finally, he tried for 9 years to sell, and finally he just gave up. He actually had a heart attack, and he was, you know, had, you know, notions of mortality. So he gave it to these two crazy producers who, you know, did not have a great track record.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally sold some studio, but the studio had so little confidence in it that they opened the first movie in drive-in theaters in the Midwest, two cities, I think one in Kentucky, one in Texas, because they didn't think anyone would want to go see a movie about a British spy who, you know, like dresses up like a metrosexual.
Yeah.
And the guy was an unknown actor, 32-year-old, who'd driven a milk truck in his previous life, you know, before film. So they're like, oh, who wants to see a movie about like a milk truck British guy? That was Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And it turned into the greatest film franchise of all time. And all the studios that had passed on it missed this incredible market. So that's kind of the same principle of why you don't want to over-focus on your projections of the market 10 or 20 years out. No, you can barely project 1 week out.
Right. And again, you know, hindsight, right? You don't even necessarily know the reasons that became popular. I remember someone asked the publisher of the Harry Potter books, which also is a similar story, right? Why it was so successful. And he goes, because a lot of people bought the book, which I think is a perfect answer to that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, you have this phrase, the problem with more. How is more problematic?
The problem with more. You mean that the idea that more is different?
Yeah, yeah.
So that actually borrows from an idea in science, in physics, that was a really great phrase invented by a guy named Phil Anderson, a Nobel laureate in the 1970s. At the time, there was kind of a battle between two camps in physics. And public doesn't really get to read about it that much or hear about it that much because one of them gets all the press and the love and the glory. And that's the kind of this understanding the science, the small, what happens inside an atom, what happens inside a nucleus, what happens inside a neutron, you know, the Albert Einsteins of the world, the Richard Feynmans of the world working on what are these fundamental laws. But this guy, Phil Anderson, represents the second camp, which is actually the majority, kind of the silent majority of physicists and scientists working on the science of the many. Why do metals conduct electricity? Why do transistors work? All these things that we see around us are the properties of many interacting particles or agents or systems. Even the behavior of financial markets, that's the property of many interacting individuals. And his point is that there's this old saying of the whole is the sum of the parts, but his point is that's not really the case. And his point is that more is different, that you get when you bring lots of things together, you get these strange, wacky behaviors that you can't explain just by studying any one individual. For example, why is water wet? This may sound like kind of a wacky question for a radio conversation, but why is water wet? More, even more interestingly, I stick my finger in a glass of water and I can swish it around and the molecules all slush around. And that's always true except when I lower the temperature, all of a sudden a critical temperature, they completely change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stick my finger in anymore. Why? The molecules inside the glass of water are exactly the same. What happens at 32 Fahrenheit? Why do they suddenly become rigid? More is different.
Hmm.
You can't understand the properties of the whole. You can't understand the fluidity of liquids or the rigidity of solids just by analyzing one molecule, because the molecules inside are exactly the same. So if you want to take off the science hat for a second, let's go back to the real world of people and humans and interactions and companies and theater stages. Why do some companies innovate well? Why do some companies fail to innovate well? Sometimes it's the exact same people. You know, I tell the story of Nokia there, which was this company that became, you may or may not remember it, but it was the king of the smartphone world.
Huge.
It was huge.
It literally had
a much more dominant market share than Apple today.
Yeah.
It literally was selling one out of every two smartphones on the planet. And incredibly, it came from nothing. 20 years earlier, Nokia was mostly famous for selling rubber boots and toilet paper. It was this conglomerate. And it was this lionized. It was celebrated on magazines. The people were, you know, these innovative geniuses. And then you had this small team inside in 2004 when they were in the top of the world that came up, you know, with the next idea. Let's build an internet-ready phone with a big color touchscreen screen and great camera and another crazy idea, another loonshot. Let's put applications online. These things, we're going to call them apps. And you can buy that and, put that on your phone and it can do stuff. And that same team shot down both projects. The same executive team, the same leadership team took these engineers and said, no, you can't do that. Shot it down. 3 years later, that was 2004, 3 years later, they watched from a distance as Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone on a stage in San Francisco, their same principles. And within 5 years, Nokia was irrelevant. And it went from a $300 billion company to selling all that stuff for around $10 billion. So they lost more than $250 billion. So more is different. It can't just be something about the individual. Something changes there.
Yeah, and
that's what
this idea, you talk about the idea that the stakes in outcome decrease while the perks of rank increase. So sometimes what Moore does is, you know, you are so bottom line focused, you're not looking at the next kind of investment. And I mean, we always talk about critical mass at Second City because we're this small theater that is the biggest player in our field, and we wonder at which point we're gonna, you know, lose it or stop seeing it. So that's it's a constant thing we're fighting with. And there's, I found it very interesting because you talk about these numbers, you know, like the number 150 being kind of a magic number, and Gladwell talked about that, and you have other stuff you talk about with that. We know the perfect size for a Second City cast to create a show is 6 because we've done it with 5, we've done it with 3, we've done it with 7, we've done it with 8, and over 60 years we've figured out, nope, this is our number for doing this part of our work. But then that number doesn't stay static because it has to be in communication with an audience, which needs to be of a certain size, and for us that's like 300. So it's figuring this out, which I kind of believe you only figure out through experiment after experiment, failure after failure, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what you say has to do with the dynamics of teams,
yep,
improvising the communication between the number of people, which really grows, you know, it doesn't grow linearly, it grows quadratically with the number of nodes that you have, number of people that you have in a team. So there's obviously a limit there. In a team or a company, the way that, you know, when you get to a larger size company, the way that works is if you have an individual walking down the street and they've got some crazy idea, they have a very high stake in how that idea works. You know, they own 100% of that success or failure. Now you put two of them together, well, they each own 50% of,
mm-hmm,
of how well that does. Now you put four of them, well, they each own 25%. Now you start making a larger team, well, you need a team captain,
mm-hmm,
right? So now you have a team captain, and so there's now two forces. One is their stake in outcome, which has already gotten smaller, but there's also getting promoted. Are you a team member? Are you a team captain? That's a different thing. Now imagine you expand that to 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people. Well, your stakes get very small in the outcome, but the perks of rank start getting higher and higher. You get fancy, you know, parking spots. You get nice vacations to Hawaii or wherever. You get, you know, maybe if you're a senior executive, you get used to the corporate jet. So all of a sudden, rather than care about the stake and outcome, you start caring about perks of rank. And so when you get that transition between the stakes of outcome getting too small and the perks of rank suddenly dominating, all of a sudden, something changes inside a group. People care more about promotion than the ultimate idea.
Yeah, I've lived through that. Okay, there's so many interesting ideas in this book, and I think there is I find that you have a love for a central character, and I believe it's pronounced Vannevar Bush. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's right. Yeah.
So amazing figure that kind of touches almost on every principle you talk about in the book. So I think let's talk about him and his amazing life and work, but also how it relates to how loon shots happen.
All right. So Bush was head of engineering at MIT in the 1930s. And he was a brilliant, not only a really brilliant inventor and engineer, invented the first analog computer and established a foundation for a lot of what ended up becoming the internet and hypertext markup and stuff. He was also kind of a genius at organization, figuring out how to bring groups together and mobilize them to innovate incredibly fast. And ultimately, well, he became President Franklin Roosevelt's chief science advisor. He talked his way into the job. Roosevelt didn't know him from Adam. But he sensed at the beginning of World War II, in the late 30s, he got a good sense from all the scientists fleeing Germany that Nazi Germany was far ahead of the United States in the radical new technologies that would be decisive. And he was right. It would become crucial in the war that didn't exist in World War One. Things like the U-boats that were sinking Allied ships faster than the Allies could build them, the German planes, the planes of the Luftwaffe. And in fact, in early 1939, two German scientists discovered something called nuclear fission, splitting the atom, which put Hitler within reach of an atomic weapon. So he understood that there was an enormous threat, and he quit his job at MIT. He built up MIT into the leading technology university in the country, which it still is today. He quit his job, left it, and the president of MIT kind of begged him to stay, that I'd make you president of the whole university. So he said, no, look, they have a national crisis here. And he moved to Washington and talked his way into a meeting, a 10-minute meeting with FDR. And that 10-minute meeting probably changed the course of the war more than any other such meeting. He told FDR, so there's a war coming and we're going to lose. It's going to be a technology-driven war, and the military is too far behind. We'll never catch up in time if we keep going. And he understood the military, too. He wasn't just an academic. He'd worked with the military for many years. So he handed Bush handed FDR one piece of paper, three bullet points, three sharp in the middle, saying, I'd like you to authorize a new group reporting to me, and I'll report only to you, and I will mobilize the nation's scientists for war. And what he did was he separated the crazy artists working on the crazy new ideas from the soldiers building the franchises. He didn't try to change culture. And that's kind of where I came at this from. When I was a young entrepreneur, I was hearing all about culture, culture, culture. Every one of the 10,000 books published every year on, you know, how to build better teams and companies and be a better leader, most of them are all about culture. He said, forget culture. Military is fine. Military has this very tight, disciplined organization. And not only will I never succeed in changing it, I shouldn't change it. He said, if we're going to build millions of guns and ships and deliver them in four continents and direct all these soldiers in battle, we need exactly that tight discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But that same tight discipline is massively counterproductive for nurturing the crazy ideas, the radical technologies that are going to win the war, for the kind of improvisational science that you need, the jazz of science that you need to create new stuff. You have to try and fail lots of stuff if you want radical innovation. It's exactly the opposite on the other side, on the military, with the soldiers. You don't want to build 10 planes, launch them into the sky, and then just sit back and see which 8 fall from the sky and crash. You don't want a lot of improvisation if you're assembling planes.
Right.
You kind of want the tight discipline and quality control. So you need those two things, and you need them to coexist. So the thing that was so interesting about Bush is he said, you know, forget this whole culture stuff. We're going to create two homes for the two types of individuals we need. We need the artists, and we need the soldiers. And this applies to companies as well, if you translate from, you know, the military to the companies that have existing big franchises that they need to deliver on time, on spec, on budget to customers. And the people inside who are working on the crazy new ideas that are the future, the pipeline. You need to separate those two. But most importantly, you have to change your mindset, because it's easy to separate people and just get a building and say, okay, everybody goes over there. If you're a crazy idea person, you go over there, and all the suits and marketers and publicity people and yada yada go in this other building. And that's what most companies do, and that's why most companies fail. Because you need to change the mindset as well. You can't just separate. You need a different mindset. And that mindset, the myth of them, the myth that's out there, the wrong mindset, is that, well, you know, these great companies have these heroic genius technology leaders, and they sit high on a mountain like a Moses, and they raise their staff, and they anoint the holy loonshot, the chosen idea, that they part the seas, and that idea just sails on through. And that's a myth. Even the great leaders who you think that was the case, that's not really what happened. And the cases where it did happen, those companies usually don't survive for very long. Bush had a very different mindset, and that's the mindset that you see in the truly successful leaders. He led not as a Moses, but much more like a careful gardener.
Mm-hmm.
He saw his job not as identifying any particular idea or technology. Even though he's a brilliant inventor, a genius inventor, he was very proud of not making any technical contribution. His job was to balance the artists and soldiers, manage the touch and balance between those two groups, meaning the flow between them. Back and forth. When new ideas, you have these little baby stage ideas in your group that's nurturing these loonshots, well, you don't want to take them out too early. They'll get crushed if you put them in the field. And you don't want to take them out too late. You want to make sure you get them out at just kind of the right time, and then they'll never work right the first time. Mm-hmm. There'll be a ton of problems, and the soldiers won't like it, the soldiers won't use it. And that's what really happened. I won't get into all the stories, but always, whether you're in the military or you're working on a product, your first version of your product won't be very good. And the marketing people won't want to sell it because it won't work very well in their demonstrations. And then the customers won't want to buy it, and everybody will just give up. And if that's all that happens, your project dies. So you have to make sure that the incentives in place and the systems in place, and people want to come back and say, well, here's exactly where it didn't work, and here's exactly how we need to improve it, and then just have a continuous cycle back. So he saw his job as managing the transfer, not the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that mindset is a much more humble mindset.
Yeah,
you don't see a great poster of, like, this guy was awesome at managing transfer.
Right.
Those aren't the heroes that are rewarded. You know, you see great posters of, like, what a genius invention. You know, what a genius hero of a brilliant scientist he is. The ones who try to build organizations on the back of their, you know, great genius ideas don't last very long. It's the people who have the more sort of humble approach like Bush did. Not that he was the most humble guy in the world, but who have a more humble approach to taking credit for inventions and ideas, those are the ones that tend to do the best.
And I think you strike at something that is a common misconception, as I understand, not improvisation just from a theatrical point of view, but I've studied a fair amount in the jazz world as well, which people have this idea that suddenly it is just a God-given talent and it shows up. But the amount of work, precision, I think of even basketball, right? Michael Jordan taking all those free throws over and over and over again so that when he's in game time, he has the ability to improvise in a moment. But it's only based on a lot of rote exercise as well. And so it's very much a thing that goes back and forth. The great improvisers and artists, and I would think this is true of scientists, never stop that. They're constantly in that exploratory. I think Danny Kahneman once said that he sees the world as a problem, and that's a positive thing because it allows him to, there's a game there that he needs to try to figure out.
Yeah, I think that's true in so many, in so many areas of life. I mean, just for example, I was giving a talk very recently to it was a very kind of a Gus group. It was a board and all their guests, 150 people for a very well-known philanthropy related to, nonprofit related to climate change and conservation. And, there are many well-known people, and they asked me to give a talk. And it was the CEO there asked me to, somewhat last minute, talk on a slightly different subject than I had often talked, than he had heard me talk about before. And I also was a supporter of their cause. So I spent days and days practicing getting it down so fluent so that I could improvise on stage. Because only when you have the baseline completely cold, then can you just like relax. And when somebody says something, you can just have fun with it because you know exactly where you're going next. So if someone wants to interrupt you, you just have a good time with it and go with it. And it was a lot of fun. Whereas if you don't, if you're constantly thinking, wait a minute, where am I going next? Or how do I shoot this? How do I position my feet for the free? You can't really relax enough to improvise. So improvising sounds like fun, but it's enormous amount of work and practice that goes in first, as I'm sure you guys do in theater.
Yep. All right, you identify essentially two types of loon shots, the P type and the S type, and that's product for P and strategy for S. And this was very enlightening to me because I started to look back at my many failures. I had a lot of successes too, but you don't learn as much from successes as you do from failures. And I'm like, oh man, that was a product failure, and that was a strategy failure. So, but I never heard it expressed in the way that you expressed it. So I want you for our audience to sort of take us through these different types of loon shots and how they express themselves.
Good. Thanks. And I'm glad you mentioned that because I think it has, I talk about it more in the context of the business world in loon shots, but I certainly thought, having spent a lot of time in the academic world and science, and having a lot of friends in the arts world, it has equal applications in kind of any creative world. But I'll start with the business, and then we can talk about it. And then I'm curious, you tell me your examples.
Okay.
But in the business world, you think of a P type or a product type is a technology that nobody says will work. And even if it does work, it's just not going to matter. Start with the telephone. Even when you start with the telephone, people just kind of laughed. Who needs this thing? It's hard to imagine in hindsight, but that really was the case. Yeah, nobody, it's just going to be a toy, no one's going to use it. So telephone, nobody said you could wear it. The transistor, nobody thought you could ever do that. That didn't need a solid state device. How could that possibly, two semiconductors, it's impossible. And even if it does, what are you going to do with it? Or jet engines, was an example there that, nobody said that first when Goddard suggested it in the 1920s, jet propulsion and liquid fueled rocket, people laughed him out of the practically laughed him out of the country. The New York Times published an editorial that this guy doesn't understand the basic laws of physics that we teach our children in high school. And, of course, 40 years later, it was exactly Goddard's ideas that got us to the moon. So those are all P-type. Those are all technologies. What's an S-type? S-type is a small change in strategy that people don't think will matter very much. So I'll give you an example. Sam Walton opened a retail store in kind of rural America, not some far outside of big cities, when everybody said, oh, you know, you're going to open a store. He was just a young guy who wanted to open a store. He liked retail, liked selling stuff. And he wanted to open a store in a big city. It just so happened, actually, that his wife says, I don't like big cities. And he said, I like quail hunting. And there was one region in the Midwest where there's these four neighboring states with four different quail hunting seasons. And if he located right there in northwest Arkansas, he could get all four seasons. So there was no change in technology. He just went to a slightly different location. He sold stuff a little bit cheaper, and he made stores a little bigger. He didn't invent retail. He didn't invent selling stuff a little bit cheaper. There was no new technology. It was just a change in strategy of what mattered. Google. Google wasn't the first search engine, the second search engine. I think it was around the 15th or 18th search engine, something like that. People had written off search technologies. People said, there's no money to be made in search. We've got it. We know how to search. There's no money to be made on it. No one could ever do it. They didn't create a new technology. They simply created a new strategy. They said, let's change how we show the results of our search. Because right now, they're just doing it. They had whatever systems they had before. They said, let's prioritize what we show users by how many links those pages have. Well, that was a different strange and chatty. Google's worth close to $1 trillion today. It was an S-type loonshot. It wasn't the only S-type loonshot, but its biggest loonshots were really S-type. It was how to monetize it. It was the second really critical one. So some of the most important breakthroughs in business are not P-type. Even though P-type, especially when I'm in Silicon Valley, I get all these, there's just obsession with product. Yeah. Let's make it bigger, faster, better. And that's a trap. Because there are these small changes in strategy that can be decisive. So that's in the business world. That we probably don't have time to talk about some of the other business stories. But since you mentioned creative artists and scientists, I always think about, and that's not, you know, I don't really have space there to talk about. Actually, I wrote some stuff that took it out. But in science, you can think of two kinds of discoveries. Let's say you create a new drug, and that's very hard work. You have chemists, you have biologists, they have to create a product, a new molecule, and that can be very difficult, and it may or may not work. A second, a very different thing, is you repurpose an existing drug. So I'll tell you, look, a brilliant change in strategy was that involved no new technology. Do you remember a drug called thalidomide?
Sure.
It was probably before OxyContin. Actually, it's probably worse than OxyContin. It had the worst reputation of any drug in history because it was given as a sedative to mothers who were pregnant, who were suffering nausea. It was a very effective sedative. It worked quite well. What they didn't know at the time was that it has damaging effects on a fetus. So thousands, tens of thousands of babies were born with deformed limbs. And many more died as a result of taking the sedative. And it took a couple years to track it down. And there was a woman in the U.S. actually who, Frances Kelsey, who prevented the drug, which is made by a German manufacturer, from being approved in the U.S., and she became a national hero. So that is the worst drug in history, arguably. Famous pictures of these, just horrific pictures of these poor children, covers of magazines. Well, about 15, 20 years ago, a physician here in Boston came up with an interesting idea for treating cancer. He said, let's see if we can treat cancer by blocking the blood flow to tumors. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was his own crazy idea. And he started to try to work on some P-type ideas. Let's find a product that could do that. But he had another idea, which is more of an S-type, which he said, I wonder if there are any drugs out there that work this way. And maybe we can repurpose them. And he said, here's a crazy thought. If there are, where do you need new blood vessels? Well, in the womb. When the mother is nurturing a child in the womb, we need to grow lots of new blood vessels. Could there possibly be any drugs that had negative effects on children? Maybe they're working by disrupting those blood vessels. How brilliant is that idea? Mm-hmm. And he discovered the drug thalidomide. Had this, you know, at that point it was an old drug and it was buried. And he said, let's take this drug and give it to cancer patients. And the second, the multiple myeloma was a terrible disease at the time. Mm-hmm. The second patient they gave it to had a near complete remission of his tumors.
Wow.
And now that drug, thalidomide, and its successors have helped transform the treatment of myeloma. They've turned it from an immediately fatal disease to one that patients are living years. So that's an example of an S-type in science. So why it's interesting that you mention it is, not only in business, if you learn what your blind spot is and how to become ambidextrous and do both well, you can enormously increase the power of your business. But as a scientist, if you're a creative scientist, if you learn not only working on better products, but what is some clever strategy for improving your reach, for taking existing stuff that you've done and applying it more broadly? And as an artist, I have a number of artist friends, you know, creating an artwork or a completely original artwork might be a product, but what are some new ways to get that product to potential customers? That's a strategy idea. And that could improve your reach as an artist.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you mentioned some examples.
Yeah.
What are you thinking of?
So the thing that has worked best from a strategy POV with Second City, so we're essentially an entertainment or a content company and an education company. So we have the shows that we put on here in Chicago and Toronto and the classes we teach to aspiring improv artists. And some years ago, like when I first started, the school was only about 100 students. But what we started realizing is that every once in a while in the class, some guy would show up who's a little bit older, who really had no interest in being a artist. He just wanted something fun to do, and he figured out, oh, wow, you know, this is actually helping me at my job when I'm in meetings. And then we would see, like, this was a funny story, that this doctor showed up, he went through the whole program, and he treats people with anxiety. And he came to us afterwards and goes, I think if we put these two things together, it could be very successful. So we created a improv for anxiety program where his patients would come. We were essentially group. They would come learn improv, and then they'd have their individual sessions with him, and they did a show at the end. So by starting to do improvisation for Alzheimer's, improvisation for Parkinson's, improvisation for caregivers, we basically took what we did and then shifted it, usually in partnership with a channel expert, and found a whole new world and a whole new audience to bring our work to. And that has almost always worked when we did it. What doesn't work is when we go completely off. So on the theater side, we would do a similar thing where Renee Fleming came to a show at Second City, and she's like, how do we do combines, you know, what Second City does in the world of opera? And we created a project with Lyric Opera Chicago called the Second City Guide to the Opera. Then we did that with the symphony. Then we did that with Hubbard Street Dance. And then I got really cocky because I was having all this success, and I'm like, hey, there's some great movies that I love that we could turn into stage work, and I got the rights to Slapshot, the Paul Newman hockey movie. This was the biggest bomb. No one came to this goddamn show. And I was like, oh, because we changed. This wasn't the formula that worked before. And by the way, you know, women buy mostly theater tickets, and they're not very interested in a misogynistic sports film that's suddenly put on stage. And sports people don't want to see that film put on stage either. So, you know, you learn in terms of what lane lane you are. And it doesn't mean that you can't go into completely other lanes. You just got to do it in the right way. And we would have been much smarter having done before we paid all the rights and put up, you know, a whole production that lost hundreds of thousands of dollars to maybe do some, you know, market testing or a table read or figure out some way that this was a very bad idea.
That's great. That's great, sir. But yeah, that's actually, I hear people using improv to improve team dynamics in the workplace. That's a real thing now. I see that all over the place. And that's a great example of an S-type moonshot.
It's a multi-million dollar business for us in that corporate work. And so that's the thing we're always looking for. Okay. This book is terrific. I could talk to you, you know, all day about it, but I know I got to let you go. The last question we ask every guest on the pod is for a yes and story. So in the parlance of our work, if you're making something out of nothing, you get nowhere saying no. And you can't even just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm sure you have a story from your life when you were going to say no, but perhaps you said yes and I'm wondering if you've got a story for us.
Well, maybe the story of this book, because, you know, I was a scientist and then I was running a in business and then running a what became a publicly traded company for a total of 13 years. And I would just give this fun talk as a little hobby. Mm-hmm. I would do, because I just found history and the kind of stories in history so fascinating. I would do 3,000 years of physics in 45 minutes. I do kind of just like for fun and entertainment, tell the stories in really funny ways. And people liked it and they were like, you should turn that in a book. You know, you should make that a book or a video or something. And I'd say, no, I'm busy. No, I'm busy. And eventually I said, yes. Mm-hmm. Eventually I said, yeah. I said, I'll make it a little essay because I wrote it into this kind of fun essay, which, you know, about this kind of crazy idea. Like, why I connected with, like, why does the world speak English? How does all of this ideas, how does it all help us understand world history? And then a friend had a book agent, and he asked me for a copy, and he said, you should really, this is more than an essay.
Yeah.
So that was like the yes and, like, not just an essay. Yes, and make it a book. So this book became a yes and story.
Yeah, the yes anding yourself is always probably the first step, and then if you can continue it down the line. And that's what I love too about the book, is that you do talk about science and you talk about history, and there's great storytelling, and so we're introduced to a lot of characters and a lot of new ideas that really provide a fresh look at what we call creativity, what we call innovation, but it's human expression into sort of uncharted territories, and it's really great. The book is called Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi Bacall, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Lord, I am so tired. How working and working.